This is the Relevant Podcast.
It's Friday, November 27th, 2020. It's Black Friday, and this is a Relevant Podcast. In Orlando, I'm your host, Cameron Strang, and joining me from Loverland, Virginia, it's Jesse Carey.
Hello, hello.
From Austin, Texas, author, podcaster, Jamie Ivey.
Hey, guys.
And from Nashville, Tennessee, artist, producer, mogul, Derek Miner.
What up, dude?
Is it too early, or is this right on time?
Hey,
I feel like in 2020...
It's a day after Thanksgiving... Listen, all good now. We can listen to Christmas music.
I feel like in 2020, we honestly could have started listening to Christmas music in September, and people have been like, that's all right, man. Like, I get it.
I thought you were going to say August. Yes. The answer is yes.
Yeah.
Hey, from it's what officially we've all been no through, shame today, though. Y'all early adopters had to kind of hide it because you were going to be shamed. Now, just loud and proud. You can listen to whatever you want. Mariah Carey, you can listen to whatever. It's all good. There you go.
Yeah.
Do y'all get tired of Christmas music,
say,
though?
I get tired of Mariah Carey.
I get tired of it real quick.
I don't mind Christmas music.
I'm not a fan.
I'm very, very tired of the Mariah Carey album. And listen, it is a legit masterpiece, right? It is a pop masterpiece, okay?
What's your favorite Christmas album?
But good Lord, okay? I mean...
I bet Mariah Carey gets tired of the Mariah Carey Christmas album, let's be honest.
No, she don't. No,
not
she
don't.
Look, hey, she writes.
I don't think... Look, and this is me throwing shade. I appreciate the hustle, and I appreciate the swag. I don't think Mariah Carey gets tired of anything related to Mariah Carey.
See, here's my thing about Christmas music, because I love it. I love Christmas music. But it's like, on one hand, I'm tired of people doing the same songs. Like when I was doing the music for this episode, because I'm going to play Christmas music and all the breaks, you know, like I love Donny Hathaway's This Christmas. So I type in This Christmas to grab the song, and literally there's like 117 covers of This Christmas. And it's just like, on one hand, it's like, can we get some new songs? But then when people try to do originals, they're terrible. I think the last Christmas original that was good was Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You. I
mean,
like, so it's like, I don't know what to do.
Want new stuff, but yet then we don't like it.
Right. It's like the same 20 songs, or they're terrible attempts at new stuff that nobody likes. So I don't
think
know.
You got to leave it alone, man. Now, I will say the Reach Records Christmas album is pretty good that I'm on.
There you go.
But it's, you know what I'm saying? I think it's good because I'm on it, but at the same time, no, for real though. Like it's definitely, if you're looking for something a little different and kind of like more like urban, it's a pretty good Christmas album for sure. I'm not gonna lie. Also, here's another one that people don't know about, that Kirk Franklin Christmas album from back in the 90s.
Yes, from 96.
Don't sleep on that one. Kirk Franklin and the family. He's a legend. Hey, Kirk, that Christmas album, Kirk, it need to get that Mariah Carey love. You know what I'm saying?
Listen, Mariah, it's Mariah Carey's overdue to be dethroned on this whole thing. And like, that's not me throwing shade against Mariah. She's you know, a legit pop music queen. I'm just saying, I think at some point the torch needs to be handed to the next person. That's all. That's all I'm saying, you know?
But I do. Who could even do that?
I literally was thinking, like, who could replace Mariah Carey with the next huge thing? I was thinking Beyonce, right? So I just typed in Beyonce. Dude, did you know Destiny's Child did a Christmas album?
I have vague recollection of that. You know?
Yeah, I didn't
know.
Well,
here's the thing. Like, if you take, to a very well-known Beyonce and Rihanna, and you're like, hey, we have an idea, Christmas album. I think they'd be like, nope, not doing it. Who cares?
Yeah. Right.
Am I right? Yeah.
True. It seems like all the artists that have like that middling debut, you know, it's like they didn't quite have a huge hit, but like they got to do a quick album to kind of build the momentum before their next real album. They do a Christmas album.
Okay, here's who needs to do one. Is John Benjamin. He is the comedian that did that experimental jazz album. Cameron, I know you know this record. It's one of my favorite albums. So the concept is this. He hired like a legit jazz band, okay? Like a really great studio jazz band to play some some staples from the American jazz music, you know, catalog or whatever. And he was saying, hey, I need you guys to play. I'm a pianist. We're going to go to the studio. We'll knock these out. What he didn't tell them is he has no idea how to play the piano, and he was just going to wing it in the studio. The result is the most hilarious album you've ever heard. Like a guy literally not knowing how to play an instrument, surrounded by great musicians, just trying to figure it out on the fly. I belly laughed throughout the entire album. If he did a Christmas album, it would be a gift. It would just be like, hey, you want to laugh? You want to hear these studio nerds like pound out some Bing Crosby while some joker on a you know, Steinway just makes a fool of the whole process? I would love it. That would be my Christmas gift, John Benjamin. Do it, please.
Look, I just sent something that is going to be extremely enjoyable for everybody on this podcast, and you will thank me later. Go ahead. This is my favorite Christmas song, by the way, of all time.
So I printed the lyrics of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And would you,
I know the lyrics.
Would you do us the honors of spitting Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer?
You know Dasher and Dancer and Prancer and Vixen, Comet and Cupid and Donner and Blitzen, but do you recall the most famous reindeer of all?
Just DMX. Come on.
Rudolph
yes.
The Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very shiny nose. And if you ever saw him, you would even see
the most gangster dude of all time is doing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. That should be an album. I would pay for a DMX Christmas album. I would pay ridiculous amounts of money for it.
Just speaking of the Christmas thing and just vibing on the season, because that's what I feel like. Everyone this year is just looking for an excuse just to vibe out a little, you know, to feel good again. Have you guys noticed that people are getting really into Christmas decoration and lights right out of the gate here? Like, I am, maybe
well,
it's just...
Well, now it's okay. Now it's okay. People...
Well, it's the Friday after Thanksgiving.
Yeah, because today it's all right. But like, yeah, the people who've been had them up for a month at this point.
Yeah,
you know.
But because they're just desperate. Everyone just... And let me ask you this. Are you guys going to go a little extra hard this year at Christmas because 2020 has just been what it is?
No. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to stack all the toilet paper that I bought off the shelves at Walmart outside my house. And that's going to be my Christmas decorations.
That's going to be your decorations?
That's going to be my decorations. That's all I'm doing. It's going to work. That's what it is.
We've had our tree up for a long time because I record a Christmas special for my podcast and YouTube.
That makes
sense.
And
we have to film that weeks ago. And so last year, our house was decorated for Christmas on Halloween. Yes, it is so early, but it's just,
your house went as production. Christmas for Halloween.
Yes. So we've had our tree up forever already, and it's already kind of boring.
But does it make it not as special if it's like half the year?
No, it feels great. I love the tree. It's awesome. I could look at it all year long. It's great.
So here's a question I have, because I don't know how you guys do this, but are you guys directly after Christmas, all the Christmas decorations come down? Or are you like me and it's like February and you're like still pulling different stuff out?
It might not be February, but I let it run. I let it run for a little bit. You know?
There's the tradition is the 12 days of Christmas are the 12 days after Christmas. That's my justification. So I can leave it up for almost 2 weeks after Christmas and you can't say nothing.
My husband is like, by Christmas Day night, he's like, okay, y'all ready? Let's start taking this stuff down. I'm like, babe, give me a few days.
Hey, in his fairness, it's been up since August. So
it's already been up for a third Halloween. Of the year. Yeah, exactly. No, I'm lucky on Christmas Day if I'm not wading through waist-deep wrapping paper. Like, that's what like Christmas Day for us is just like it's great, but it is savage. Like, just stuff everywhere. You know, you're climbing over Hot Wheels
boxes. That stresses me out so much.
I don't mind. It's the one day, Christmas morning into evening is the one time being basically a hoarder is acceptable, because you've got all the presents everywhere. You've got all the wrapping paper. And look, you just want to kick back, watch a little b-ball. It's Christmas Day. You don't want a chore, you know? The worst thing, too, and the other, get all assembly out of the way before Christmas morning.
I spent far too
many Christmases the whole day building elaborate, you know, weird kid stuff or furniture. Get that out of the way. That's a little Christmas pro tip there.
Yeah. Oh, am I the one with the oldest kids on here? My oldest is 16. Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
Listen, guys, we're not building anything at the Ivy House anymore. Now we're like, what you want for Christmas costs how much money? Oh my gosh. Like, what? You want an external monitor for your camera? I mean, just wait, you guys. There's no more building. It's just you're buying money. Money.
You swap building for money?
Yep.
Hey, honestly, dang. I've had my hand smashed by so many little IKEA little hammers. I'll switch out for money. I don't care. I'm done with those Allen wrenches.
Well, we have a great show in store for you today. Coming up later, we have director Ron Howard.
Who?
Like Hollywood so royalty.
Hey.
Ron Howard.
So hey, you guys know something about Ron Howard?
The t-shirt, right?
People?
Pharrell. Oh, yeah. Ron Howard. I'm sorry. It's just
relevance,
the hits keep on coming.
I get people tell me all the time that my husband looks like Ron Howard. And I think my husband is like so attractive. I'm so into him, right?
Yeah.
I'm not into Ron Howard. So there's that. But people tell me that they look alike.
Is your husband bald?
He has really, she keeps his hair really short. And
I've only seen him in hats. So I just don't know. So it's a mystery.
I don't want to throw him under the bus or anything. But, you know, it's a little thin back there. Well,
so, I mean, maybe when he's a little older, Ron Howard.
Cameron, who
looking
did,
right
who
at
did,
Ron Howard.
Who did the Ron Howard interview?
Tyler, our very own Tyler Huckabee.
He should have had him like say, hey, before we wrap up, can we just script a couple things? Like, and no, he didn't. Actually, not. Like, just like the Arrested Development narrator voice. Like, you should have just had him lay down a bunch of those so you could just pipe them in at customized times. But, you know, maybe we'll have another opportunity.
Have Ron Howard narrate the relevant podcast. I like it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it would be, for example, hey, guys, I'm really excited. I got a great slice today. And Ron Howard would be like, actually, it's a pretty mediocre slice. Like,
we have a great show in store for you today. Turns out they didn't. Yeah. For this week's wellness segment coming up later, we talked to health and fitness expert Tana Amon. We talked to her as well. That segment that we've been doing. You know, it's the day after Thanksgiving gluttony. You know, people are thinking, man, I got to shed a couple for all those Christmas parties. You know, so that's why we're helping you out later on the show today.
I just let it go. From Thanksgiving to January 2nd, it's just
it's January 2nd. Everything's off the table.
It's just Jerry Falwell, dude. Belly button out.
That's why we're doing a wellness segment right now, because that's been everybody's 2020. You know, like we're just sitting around. Like, I'm not going out. I don't need to look good. I'm not getting dressed up for anything. Just let's Jerry Falwell this thing, you know?
That's
like,
it, bro.
Let's try
that's going to be the new saying.
Falwell.
That could mean a lot of stuff. That could mean a lot of stuff.
A lot of stuff. Be careful saying that one. Oh, you're overeating. Yeah. Thank God. I thought, okay, that's fine. That's fine. Okay. Woo. Oh, I thought I needed to say something, Derek. You mean you're overeating. Okay. Falwell. Oh, my God. Okay.
So
we're good. We're good, I think.
Belly button out, baby. That's me.
All right. Stay tuned. Up next, it's relevant news.
Hang all the mistletoe. I'm going to get to know you better. This Christmas, and as we trim the tree, how much fun it's gonna be together. This Christmas, the fireside is blazing bright. We're caroling through the night, and this Christmas will be.
You're listening to Donny Hathaway. The song is This Christmas. The original. There's about 300 covers. Well, today's show is brought to you by UHSM. These days, finding affordable, quality healthcare is more difficult than ever. So if you're looking to save up to 50% on your healthcare expenses, listen up. You don't have to wait around hoping healthcare will improve in the U.S. Instead, join millions of Christians who are choosing HealthShare memberships like UHSM. UHSM is a nonprofit Christian HealthShare with the sole mission of helping you achieve your best health. Protect your health with modern health sharing from UHSM, including programs with prescription benefits from CVS Caremark, no-cost telehealth visits, and access to 1 million doctors and providers. Satisfy your medical needs and save up to 50% with UHSM HealthShare. UHSM is member-to-member health sharing, and it's awesome. See why millions are choosing this Christian alternative to traditional insurance. Ask if you qualify for UHSM membership today. Call or text 833-367-8476. That's 833-367-UHSM. Or visit uhsm.com/care. That's uhsm.com/care. Check it out. They're awesome. All right. It's time for... Relevant. So soothing. Welcome to the show, Relevant Senior Editor Tyler Huckabee, to tell us what's happening this week at the intersection of faith and culture. Hey, Tyler.
Hey, everybody.
What's going on this week other than holidays and election transitions?
Before we get into it, I'm sure you all have covered this. I just wasn't here for it. Jesse's wearing sunglasses. Is this going to be just his thing now? Like, actually, drummer of the band? Is it
actually,
like
Tyler, it's a migraine thing. Yeah. So we didn't talk about it.
It's okay. I made a joke about it earlier, too.
It's not on the show, though.
What if Tyler, you know, I'm just going to say it. I don't care if listeners hear this, okay? I get migraines sometimes and I have to wear sunglasses because I get incredibly sensitive to light, but it has made me think, like, what if I was just sunglasses guy and I didn't offer an explanation? I would just like, at what point does someone just decide I'm sunglasses indoors guy? Like I appreciate Bono. That in people. Yeah, exactly.
Like Bono can get away with it. Bono's a rock star.
But Bono's,
Bono is Bono.
But Bono's
Bono
are
do
like
whatever
just,
he wants.
He's just like colored glass, though. I mean, it's not like, you know what I mean? It's like he's looking at the world through a red filter. Yeah.
Hey, have you noticed this when like it's, I've only seen it happen with a couple of actors, right? But when you get to a certain level of just like unmitigated cool, you make very terrible eyewear decisions. Okay. Like Bono's a great one because he's wearing those indoor sunglasses, but Brad Pitt went through a phase too, where he's wearing like half sunglasses all the time just because he's Brad Pitt. It's not a great look, but he just reached that Bono level where who's going to say anything on Brad Pitt?
That's the thing. It's like he's surrounded by people who will only tell him he looks good.
Russell Westbrook's another one who very ridiculous. He's wearing Sally Jesse Raphael glasses, but no one's going to tell him they're ain't cool.
You know? Because like then you're not cool because you don't even understand how cool this is.
Yeah.
So you can't call it out, but you just look silly. This ain't going to age well.
But you're going to end up on a BuzzFeed listicle in like 10 years and it's like, here's 15 worst celebrities glasses. Who made terrible eyewear decisions in the 2000s. You know?
Well,
and
I'll tell you who's not on that list. You.
Because
you're rocking those Ray-Bans.
Mm-hmm. That's right. These are classic, guys.
It's the Lower Stakes version of the pastor thing we've talked about, where pastors always need somebody who can tell them, hey, you're getting off base here. We need to check in. Celebrities don't worry about that. Nobody cares. But fashion-wise, they do. You need somebody who you look ridiculous. This is not cool, and it's never going to be cool.
Yeah. Hey, homie, I see what you're going for, but tassels, I don't think they're happening. This is me. This is what accountability is all about.
All right. Relevant news this week. Let's start off by talking a little bit about while the president has not yet technically conceded the election, President-elect Joe Biden is kind of moving ahead. He seems to be more or less ignoring what the Trump administration is doing. He may not even be totally aware of what's going on, and he's starting to float some names for possible cabinet positions. Among those names, there's a guy by the name of Tony Blinken. He is being floated for a potential Secretary of State position. He's a well-known advocate for global alliances, so this would be a pretty big shift from the Trump administration. He was the Deputy Secretary of State during the Obama administration, got a very long resume, and can include, among his many accomplishments, a meeting with the delegates from Sesame Street. This was the most looked at story on Relevant Magazine yesterday. there was a clip back in 2016 when he was Deputy Secretary of State. Blinken went on Sesame Street. He spoke with a Sesame Street delegate, Grover, about, he talked about something that's actually pretty close to the heart of, to all of our hearts here at Relevant, about refugees. Clark, I got a little clip from that. You can play that.
One of the issues we're going to talk about is something really important.
Yeah?
Refugees.
Oh, Deputy Secretary Tony Blinken from the State Department. I know all about refugees.
You do?
Of course I do. They are the ones who wear striped shirts and blow whistles at soccer games.
Now, Grover, that's referee. I'm talking about refugees. These are people who've had to leave their homes because life in their countries was not safe for them. Grover, can you imagine how difficult it would be to have to leave your home?
No, I cannot. I would never want to leave Sesame Street. I cannot imagine leaving my apartment or my pet turtle Rufus behind.
Well Grover, sadly, refugees have to leave everything behind. Communities, schools, friends, even all of their favorite things. And all kinds of people are refugees. And even though they come from many different places, they're just like you and me.
Oh, like my friends on Sesame Street. We are all different in some ways, but in a lot of other ways, we are the same.
That's right. And we all have something to learn and gain from one another.
So they
I love
on.
That, guys.
Pretty good. I mean, pretty decent. It's actually worth, it's about a 3-minute clip. And I'll be honest, I thought Grover, you know, he's a little slow on this one, but I thought I laughed out loud.
Seems like you should know this.
The referee line got me, though. That was good. It was a good one.
But Tyler, he lives in a trash can, not under a rock, okay? We know the difference.
That's Oscar. Oscar the Grouch lives in a trash can.
Well, Grover has less of it.
He's in an apartment, he says.
Grover's the blue one who does this.
Yeah. He has a whole pet turtle. Did he hear Rufus? He's got a whole pet turtle. So this is kind of like we, as you might imagine, the Biden administration's shift on this is potentially going to be the biggest thing they bring to the U.S. foreign policy situation. Joe Biden has said that he will boost the U.S. annual refugee cap to 125,000. That's an enormous jump. It's currently at 15,000. But it is a return to sort of the pre-Trump era stage. This isn't historically that big of a number, but it definitely is a shift from where it's been over the last 4 years. And this is going to be kind of a good thing for a lot of our friends and faith groups who work with refugees who've had to see their budgets slashed, obviously seen their work slashed because there just hasn't been enough federal funding and certainly not enough work to go around in terms of bringing refugees here to the country. So that part is definitely going to be a boon to a lot of faith groups out there. While the Biden administration is likely to face steep opposition from certain faith groups as well, particularly on the abortion front, Blinken's likely nomination does appear to be a sign that Biden intends to follow through on promises he's made regarding refugees.
Interesting.
I think refugees are, you know, a paramount issue, in my opinion. I think it's awesome what the, you know, incoming administration is doing to, you know, make America a destination and place that can assist the world's most vulnerable. I also think that we should be more open to political discourse through the lens of Grover because it's honestly more watchable than most of the political analysis.
It made perfect sense.
Yeah. because yeah, I feel like if Grover's talking about something, it automatically shows like if something's ridiculous and Grover's talking about it, then it's like, but then Hunter Biden's emails showed up on a laptop. But Rudy Giuliani said it was left. And there's clues about Ukraine. And then you can just be like, Grover, what literally are you talking about right now?
Like, that's a really good Grover, Jesse.
That's a very convincing
Grover.
Considering you didn't know where he lived. You had that.
Pretty good, right?
But Hillary's emails from this private server?
So in your world here, Grover is the conspiracy right-wing conspiracy theorist.
And then when he says stuff,
I thought you were saying like you wanted Sesame Street to like host C-SPAN or something.
No,
like, to just bring some levity. Okay.
And it can be on either side too. It just like the ridiculous arguments, just have Grover say them because
Elmo
it automatically
seems like a leftist to me. Grover.
Yeah. Elmo.
Radical. Like a Marxist.
Comrade Big Bird.
Yeah. Elmo wants to share everything. He's a socialist.
No, that's socialist for sure.
Yeah.
Isn't there like the count, the, you know, he's the capitalist. He's the one, you know, really concerned about numbers and things, you know.
So the count is the Treasury Secretary.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, he's like CNBC, the finance coverage.
He's got a half hour after Kramer, after Jim Cramer's on, after Mad Money, you know, the Steve Mnuchin of the
Other news, we've got this is sort of an interesting study that confirms something that we've sort of been seeing, but it's interesting to see another study that affirms this for the time being. So it's the second it's the second annual Religious Freedom Index, which is a report on how Americans are feeling about religious freedom. Okay. And this is put up, this is sponsored by this law firm called Beckett. And they found something that was sort of a little, maybe a little bit unexpected over the course of quarantine, which is that no age group over the course of this year has relied on faith more than Generation Z, more than the Zoomers have. Okay, so 74% of Gen Z responders said faith was at least somewhat important. That's a higher number than any other generation. On average, 62% of all Americans across all age groups, 62% said faith was at least a little bit important for making it through COVID-19. 64% of the silent generation, for the most part, the oldest generation, agree that made them the second most likely generation to say faith was at least somewhat important. And Gen X was the lowest at 56%. And actually, Gen Z was also the most likely to say that faith had been extremely important to them. 51% said wow. The least important to say faith was extremely important. Millennials, 31%. So a pretty big gap here. And it's a little hard to know what to make of this yet. Gen Z is still too young to extrapolate a whole lot of predictive data about what this means for the future of the country, the future of faith in America. It's possible that for some Gen Z members, they're still at home, they're still with their parents, so they're still kind of glomming on to the faith that their parents gave them. That can change. It typically does change a little bit after they graduate and get out into the world. But it also could be a pendulum swing away from sort of the declining faith that we've seen over the past few generations. They've seen that. They don't like how it's worked out for older generations. So Gen Z could be seeing sort of a return to the sort of levels of faith that we saw more in the 50s and 60s.
Wow. Okay, and just remind me, Gen Z is like the youngest people right now.
The oldest Gen Z right now is about, depending on which metric you're using, you're talking about 24, 25 years old.
Okay, and then next after that?
Millennials.
Okay, got it. Got it.
Millennials are, 24 to upper 30s. It's about 15 years. And then you've got Gen Z is between 97 and 2015 or so. Yeah. That's Gen Z. Which is crazy. Because like to your point, Tyler, I agree. A big chunk of them are still living at home.
Yeah.
But they're in households that are Gen X parents.
Gen X
is the lowest of the faith thing.
Yeah.
So that doesn't make sense to me, other than they've seen their parents reject faith and maybe they're clinging to it more than people expected.
I have a theory about that. And this is anecdotal.
Can you do it in the voice of Grover?
Well, my thinking is the spiritual, but not, no, I think, that generation has shown sort of an affinity for, taking stance on like moral, ethical, and social issues. Equality seems to be very important, but they also seem to be, and I think we've ran other studies in the past that indicated that they kind of have a feeling that they're spiritual, but not religious. I feel like other studies have shown, especially Gen Z, they're very empathetic. You look everything from, after a school shooting or, some of the loudest voices for climate change advocacy are in Gen Z. And that kind of identifying as spiritual, but not religious. I have a theory about that term, and people who kind of self-identify as that is that eventually that distinction goes away. Like, I feel like the older people get, they realize that spirituality and religion don't have to be mutually exclusive things, that they kind of slowly merge, and that spirituality that they've come to embrace eventually makes them quote unquote more open to religion, even if they didn't self-identify that. Because I feel like any kind of spiritual impulse will ultimately lead you into a direction of some sort of religion, hopefully, to Christianity, the teachings of Christ. But I actually think that impulse, if it's planted in somebody young, will turn them religious later in life. That's, again, I don't have evidence for that, but it seems to be something that's observable, at least anecdotally,
So you're saying this is a good thing if what we're looking at this?
For sure. Yeah. I get encouraged when I hear someone say I'm spiritual but not religious, because that's a great impulse. I think it's more important for someone to say that than say I'm religious but not spiritual. Like, I feel like it's you're better off saying, look, I feel some sort of impulse. I don't know what it is, and I don't feel comfortable assigning some sort of institutional understanding to it, but I want to chase this, because I do feel like, the Holy Spirit will lead people in the right direction, than someone saying, I'm religious, but I'm not spiritual at all. I don't,
law abiding.
Exactly. And I think that's maybe why we're kind of seeing this swing in the generation. Again, anecdotal, but Tyler, do you feel like that kind of squares with some of the studies you've read?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. And it's important to remember here that we're talking pretty soft science so far. And there's a, and like you said, and this is true, this has been shown to be true in lots of Barna research as well. The question of when the word faith or the word spirituality just means different things to different people. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to figure out in a survey, like a simple survey question, what people mean when you say rely on faith. Well, a lot of people have a different idea about what that could look like. And yeah. It's going to mean one thing to the greatest generation, Gen X, boomers, than it does to Gen Z and millennials. So until we get a better metric for defining that, that's another reason it's be important to not extrapolate too much out of that data, but definitely true that the definition of what faith looks like or how it manifests or what praxis is for younger generations from millennials, there's a big divide between millennials and older generations on that one, especially.
All right, what else you got?
The last thing we want to talk about a little bit is we're coming into what's usually sort of the if it's been a rough year for Hollywood, they look to December to pull them out of the slump, because the Christmas movie season is always big and always pulls in a lot of money. That is probably not going to be the case this year. As Jamie, our insider on theater going, knows, not going to be a lot of our roving reporter on the ground. So we're seeing movies.
Tyler, before you get into what you're bringing, did you see the news that last weekend coming into Thanksgiving, which, as you just said, is the kickoff to the big holiday box office? The number one movie in America is the movie Freak. And the total box office for that movie to be number one was $1.2 million.
Oh, my gosh.
The lowest,
heard of this movie.
The lowest that's number rough. One in movie history.
Wow.
Wow.
Which is because there's like seven theaters open. Mm-hmm. New York's totally shut down. LA's totally shut down. They just closed 400 Regals again. I mean, it's like,
don't worry, my son's still working, guys. There you go.
Jamie's family was 30% of the national box office.
Really blurring the line between first and last responder over there in the Ivy household.
Yep.
So in the middle of all this, and you probably saw this was announced last week, but this was what could end up being a pretty seismic moment in the film industry, which is when Warner Brothers announced that Wonder Woman 1984, which is supposed to be their big 2020 tentpole movie, expected to pull in at least $1 billion, they announced would be releasing on HBO Max on the same day that it releases in movie theaters on Christmas Day. So they could be looking at upwards of a $1 billion hit on this, but they're saying this is what life and movies looks like, at least for this era and potentially for every era moving forward. Shortly after that, Disney followed suit with Soul, their big Pixar offering this year, which was again going to rake in a lot of money for them, is now going straight to Disney Plus on Christmas Day. Both of these movies, every reason to think they're good, every reason to think they'd be profitable in a different time, but they're just not happening right now. And will that be the case moving forward for movies, even after the vaccine starts rolling out? We just don't know, but it's kind of looking like the era of going to movies as we knew it is maybe not ever going to really return.
I wonder how the Mulan movie did, because that was the first.
It went straight to Disney.
It did not do very well.
Tried to charge $30 for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't know, but the assumption was that if that worked well, that's what they would have done for Soul, for a Black Widow. Uh-huh. They would have started doing that for all of their big movies, and they have not followed suit on any of those yet. So the assumption is it underperformed pretty significantly.
So for Soul, they're not charging. It's just going straight to the...
If you've got a Disney Plus membership, then you'll be able to see Soul on Christmas Day.
This is kind of devastating.
This is kind of surprising to me because, you know, Cameron, I know you and I were, you know, talking basketball the other day and about, you know, how the NBA will still have a version of fans and gathering people
in some arenas, not all.
But I also feel like from what I've read and probably, Cameron, some of the buzz that you've heard, you know, I know you and I are both sports fans and don't just like sports themselves, but like the business of sports too, are very both interested in that. And that it seems like most league executives are projecting that there is a future on the horizon where, you know, crowds once again gathering will be somewhat commonplace once again. I mean, we saw in like Thailand a week ago where they hadn't had a positive COVID case in like 200 days. You know, they were much more aggressive early on with lockdowns and things like that. But they had a big, gigantic outdoor music festival with people packed in, you know, like when vaccines become widely available and distributed, do you guys think that people are going to be returning to movie theaters? And if you're a studio executive, do you just punt the movies till the spring when people are getting vaccinated and going back to the movies? I don't know if this is forever. What do you guys think?
I think people will go back. I mean, right now we're seeing, like, I'll take, you know, in Austin, for example, we have really high numbers here in Texas. You know, we hit the first state with the million cases. So it's really high. We're at stage four again, out of stage five in Austin. But yet it feels like when you look around, people are like, I just want life to be back to normal. And so they're still taking precautions, but they're doing things that they weren't doing in March, if that makes sense. And so I think people are going to be craving to get back to quote unquote normal, whatever that might be.
I can't wait. I'm not even going
to
lie.
I mean, I'll get my tickets back to the Texas games next year. I mean, like, I can't wait to go back to that. You know, that's something that we had to, you know, hunt on.
Like, I don't even want to and I might be tripping, but I'm not even really trying to even experience the movies how they're happening now. Like, I want packed movie theater full of people where when the moment happens, the whole theater goes, yeah, you know what I mean? Like, I want that. Like, I love that experience. So yeah, I'll tell you, as soon as things begin to look safe, or, you know, we figure out what's what, that's what I'm banking on, is that. But I don't think, I think it can be both. I think that the movie theaters can come back and they're still releasing stuff on HBO Max early, or Disney Plus early too. So I don't know.
Am I the only one that's been to a movie during COVID?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah, sorry, guys.
It'll be interesting. There's a lot of organizations, including travel. I mean, like, travel is a big debate right now because it's holiday weekend. Qantas Airlines said that they're going to impose a policy once the vaccine is available, that they're going to require a card showing that you've had the vaccine before they'll allow you to fly the airline. And yeah, other major airlines are going to follow suit. I think that's going to become what the major gathering places are going to start doing. The theme parks, the music festivals. It's like, okay, if you want to come gather maskless and kind of have that normalcy, you need to show us that you're clean. You know what I mean?
I don't know what I feel about that.
I don't like that.
I don't like it either.
That's very scary.
It's like that girl in your videos, Derek, where she got she got it, and then
I was like, maybe she was right.
Yeah.
But like, going to a Magic game, they reached out and they were testing the waters about some of the policies that they're going to experiment with to ensure a safe environment for a limited number of fans. And they were just asking feedback of like, if this was required, what would you think? If this was required, what would you think? And one of the things the NBA is planning to do for the arenas that can have some limited fans for the new season is that they will administer rapid testing upon entry, or you have to bring a thing that says in the last 48 hours you've been tested and that you're negative, and that you will have to wait for that 15 minutes to get cleared to enter the building. And it's like, I think it's going to be that. So maybe if you don't want to have the vaccine, you're just going to have to prove that you get tested before you can enter any of these places. I think that's going to be 2021 for a lot
of
places.
That's fine.
I'll
take a test. You could take my temperature. I'll take a test. But I think that if you tell me that I have to put a vaccine in my body to come to your establishment, I'm out on that. I don't think that's cool. What if I just don't, you know, especially as a minority, like, minorities, vaccines and different things like that, they affect us differently because our bodies are different. But most of the time, the people that they're like, yo, this is 90% effective, is 90% effective on a white body. You know what I mean? So for me, I'm very selective with what I put in my body, especially when it comes to like pharmaceuticals and things of that nature. So like, for me, I'm out. Like, if you're telling me I gotta get a vaccine, I'm out there. But you could take a test, you can put the put that big long Q-tip up my brain or whatever you trying to do. I'm down with that. But bro, you're not going to make me put no syringe in my arm. I'm just not doing it.
I just think the America, major establishments are going to find a way to ensure the safety so you can gather with a peace of mind that it's safe here and I don't have to be all skittish and all this. Because that's what it's going to take is that people feel comfortable again. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
you get three choices.
You know, there is something about this movie thing that makes me really sad though. You guys, this would be our 8th anniversary on Christmas Day to go to Alamo Drafthouse. It's a movie theater here in town that you can eat at.
And we have one in Orlando.
Okay, awesome. So Alamo Drafthouse, they do these quote-alongs. And every Christmas Day, we go to an elf quote-along. My kids dress up. Oh, they've got reindeer onesies on.
This would be our eighth year,
and we can't do it. So that's just added to the list of things that we're missing out on. I know, but... we'll go see another movie, you guys, where my son's working.
Side note, Elf is the greatest Christmas movie of all time. Don't debate
me. Hands down.
A lot of places near me are doing this thing. You get three options. You can either, you know, do the COVID test, do a quick wash of bleach in the lungs, quick inject, or just a blast of UV, and I think you're good. From my understanding, you can go back, get in that theater, get to that photo wall, you know? Just blast some UV. I'm sorry. It's too
leave
funny.
That man, 2020 leave that man was alone, too funny. Jesse.
There was so much comedy we left on the table. Can we just all admit that? It was so weird for a while. Everyone was so angry. Can we just all look back at all the comedy that was just left on the table?
The fact that the leader of the free world was having a pandemic update, daily update, and was up there with the eyes of the globe watching him, riffing about possible ways maybe we could be cured.
Speculating.
In front of the world is just mind-boggling.
That's what I'm saying.
My man was
so
freestyling,
he was freestyling, just like, I don't know. What do y'all think? Yeah? Yeah. It's the leader of the free world, man. You're not in a meeting right now. You're on camera.
So how about this? How about this? Tanning salons instead of hospitals. I don't know. I'm just saying... why not?
It doesn't like the light.
My point isn't, I'm not trying to be like political or snarky. I'm just saying, we can see the other side of all of this. Don't you think that there was just mountains of comedic gold that we all were just like, guys, no one's got the energy for this anymore. But now it's like, what were we doing? This was hilarious.
It's too soon.
There was a report in the New York Times yesterday from Maggie Haberman, who's their Washington reporter. They're kind of their star talent right now. And she reported that one thing that is helping, you know, it's been kind of a rough day for the president, rough week for the president, but he does this week have his favorite presidential activity, his favorite thing to do as president, which is pardon those turkeys. This year it's Corn and Cobb are two turkeys who get the... Now, I thought about this a little bit. I have some problems with the president. It seems kind of weird, the part like, we're pardoning turkeys, but we're not pardoning people on death. You know, there's like moral...
There's some ethical issues
with it. But I couldn't laugh too hard because... I think if I was president, it'd also be my favorite thing. Like that would be fun. That would rock. It's like your little petting zoo, and you get to go hang out with turkeys.
Plus, who's gonna criticize it? Who's not gonna? What kind of sociopath is gonna be like, nah, just kill Corn and Cobb? That would show them. It's like, no. This is the one thing a president can do that universally is like, that was kind of cool. At least Corn and Cobb are still having a good day. You know, at least you know. And I gotta tell my kid what happened to Corn and Cobb. Oh, well, they're getting eaten tonight.
Corn and Cobb.
Yeah. It's like that is Tyler, you're right, man. If there's one thing that can unite a divided America, even just for a moment, it's watching Corn and Cobb live another day. You know?
Yeah.
At the discretion of the leader of the free world.
Exactly.
I love it.
All right. Thanks, Tyler. For more coverage like that, check out everything we're posting every day at relevemagazine.com. Stay tuned. Up next, Ron Howard joins us.
Late night with the candlelight. Heaven bound, that's a big invite. Colorblind to the black and white. Show your love and feel all right.
It's the joint, bro. It's a vibe.
Cut the future bright. Stuck together and we hold it tight. Stand down through the dynamite. All aboard on the freedom ride. Time to sail down the riverside. Kept going, never satisfied. Hit the guides, it's glory.
You're listening to All Is Bright featuring Wande, 1K Few, and Derek Minor. It's on The Gift, a Christmas compilation from Reach Records. Go check it out. It's got a good cover, too.
Derek, I got a question about Christmas compilations, because that is, they're reliably fun to listen to, because they're always, like, people are mixing it up. You get a variety of artists and styles of songs. Do you pick the song, or does the label, like, hey, man, will you do whatever? How does that work?
So most of the time, what happens with me, especially when it's a feature, they're just like, hey, we have this record we think you'll be a good vibe on. Here, check this out. And usually you just hop on it or say, nah, that's whack. So
yeah.
It's most of the time it's the producer or the executive producer that kind of picks and chooses who goes on what with who. You know what I mean?
Gotcha.
And you just kind of just decline or accept whether you want to be on that record. Sometimes you'd be like, yo, send me something else. And they might shoot you something else, but you know, it's all about vibes and creativity.
Though. Yeah.
Ron Howard is an Academy Award winning film director, producer, and actor. You may or may not remember his role on The Andy Griffith Show as a kid, which I still watch, or his narration on Arrested Development. But these days, he spends the majority of his time behind the camera, creating films like Cinderella Man, Apollo 13, Star Wars Solo, and countless others. We recently sat down with Ron to talk about his new movie, Hillbilly Elegy, why this story was personal for him, and why he's so drawn to movies about real life. Here is Ron Howard.
Well, I thought your mama was going to be all right. Be happy. I know I could have done better. But you got to decide you want to be somebody or not.
I've been doing real good.
When I read the book, I really related to the characters. I found the book very interesting, but what caught my eye and sort of, my piqued my curiosity were the family members. And one thing jumped out at me, because my family roots are in Oklahoma, and a small town in Oklahoma, Duncan, and then farm country. My dad was from a farm. And I called my great-grandmother Mamaw, and I thought that was just her nickname. I didn't realize that it was a broadly used cultural, name for grandmothers. So that was one of the things that caught me right away when I read the book. When I started talking to JD about it, and learning even more about his family story, and frankly, hearing his voice, his accent, his cadences, it just felt very, very familiar to me. Even though, my people are from the Midwest and in his Kentucky and then in Ohio, but I've been interested in trying to find a family story that dealt with kind of rural America in a way that I could connect with and relate to. And I began to believe that Hillbilly Elegy was it. And I'm really glad I had the opportunity to make the movie. There's something very powerful in choosing a subject where, you can witness something extraordinary. It happened. And it's not, and you can present it to an audience, not as fiction, not as something you wish could happen, but as something that has occurred. And I think that in the relationship between the storyteller and the audience, it's kind of that understanding in some ways allows the filmmaker to be to take even bigger risks with characters. When audiences know it's based on a true story, they tune in a slightly different way. It's kind of a different sort of an exchange. It's still meant to be exciting, exhilarating, emotional, dramatic, and entertaining in those ways. But you kind of connect with audiences' hearts and minds in a slightly different way. And that appeals to me. Now, as a kid, I always loved history. The first film I ever made that was a serious film was actually a documentary about the Depression that I made when I was in high school. And so I've always been fascinated by true stories. I was just afraid to delve into them. was a kid on the Andy Griffith Show, Andy used to get very upset about the Beverly Hillbillies because he'd say that that's farce and that's okay, but we're not the Beverly Hillbillies. He didn't mind that the Beverly Hillbillies was successful or anything. It didn't bother him at all. But when the writing would sort of push things in a farcical direction, he would say, look, where I come from, those people, they're plenty funny on their own. We don't have to reach that far for it. For him, there was a real dividing line. So all these years later, I certainly was trying to avoid tropes. I talked to, interviewed people, country western singer songwriters, and just sort of, documentarians who had focused a lot on the region. So I kind of wanted to understand what the tropes were and how that could be avoided. Ultimately, I kept going back to the research that JD was handing me. His movies, his home movies, him taking me to Jackson, Kentucky and showing me the holler. I know it's authentic because it is, but it's not going to be everybody's experience from Appalachia or the Rust Belt. So I recognize that as well. My first family story that is based on real events. Other movies that I've done that, well, Cinderella Man was arguably a family story as well. I care about characters. I care about dimensional characters. I'm not that interested in bad guys. I'm really interested in the way people work together to try to achieve something. When you talk to JD, he does not think of this as a pull yourself up by your bootstrap story at all. He thinks of it, more as a rescue story. He feels that he simply would not have been able to achieve any of these ambitions, any of these goals without the important women in his life, especially Mama and his sister, Lindsay. That really interested me, that this was a story about people who could have difficult lives, packed with regrets, some of which they own, some of which they feel the victims of, circumstances. But at a particular moment, they may have the opportunity to make a huge difference in the life of somebody who they care about, and perhaps, and change the course of a family. JD himself leaned very heavily on his papa, and in his mind, his grandfather, papa, was a great guy. After he passed, he began to recognize that papa had made some mistakes. And it wasn't until he was older that he began to realize that it was in fact the women in his life who had made the difference. When we were beginning to adapt the book, I said, what were the two most dangerous periods, in your life? He cited these two times, is when he was 13 and 14, and then again, when he was at Yale. I was surprised by the Yale answer. I thought it might have had something to do with the Marine Corps, which was so important to him. And he said, well, the Marine Corps was important, but it was primarily almost 100% positive. It was Yale where it almost all came tumbling down. And I thought that was very surprising, but it was at Yale that he began to realize that there was so much he could lose. When he was a boy, he knew he felt bad. He knew he wasn't happy, but he couldn't see the forest for the trees. So in a way, at that time, he didn't even recognize that he'd been rescued by his very heroic grandmother. And I think in a lot of ways, that's why he wanted to write the book. And it was the thing that he was the most protective of when it came to adapting it. We couldn't get close to getting all of Mama's warts, but she was wild. She was profane. She was devout. I mean, she was a paradox and a fascinating one. And Glenn really brought her to life in a powerful way, I thought.
You've always got a reason. It's always someone else's fault. Some point, you're going to have to take responsibility, or someone else is going to have to step in.
Who? Huh? Who?
This was about these turning points in our lives that, to anybody else on the outside, you might not even notice it's happening, but within your family, it's historic. It's seismic. And was trying to find those twists and those turns and those turning points in JD's life that were really the ones that we needed to dramatize. You don't get a lot of comfortable time in the movie, sort of recognizing the times of peace and harmony, of which there were some. But this is about these two periods where he was most in jeopardy emotionally and to some extent physically, and where his future was most in doubt. And so it was really filtering through his life, not just the book, but also all of these interviews, and identifying something that we could present in the framework of an entertaining, engrossing, suspenseful, emotional movie narrative so that people could sit and watch it and lose themselves in it in the way you hope they will.
That was Ron Howard. Check out his new movie, Hillbilly Elegy. It's out now.
Jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh. O'er the fields we go, laughing all the way.
You're listening to Lauren Daigle. The song is Jingle Bells. It's Christmas, y'all. Well, it's time for our weekly fall wellness series. This week, we talked to best-selling author, neurosurgical ICU trauma nurse, and health expert Tana Amon about mental health, brain health, and a lot more. Remember, this series is brought to you by UHSM, member-to-member health sharing. See why millions are choosing this Christian alternative to traditional insurance. Ask if you qualify for UHSM membership today by visiting uhsm.com/care.
I've been excited for this conversation. Could you start by maybe just giving me an overview of who you are and what you do?
So my name is Tana Amon. I'm the vice president of Amon Clinics. I've written 10 books, but my new book, The Relentless Courage of a Scared Child, is very different. It's a memoir. Never thought I would do that. It's you know, if someone doesn't like the nutrition advice you give, not a big deal. If someone doesn't like your personal story or they criticize it, yeah, that's a little more painful, right? So, but I just felt like it was time. I sort of felt like I was being called to do this. And so here I am. Yeah, it's Amon Clinics. We look at people's brains and we connect their brain health to their behavior. And it's very interesting when you begin to do that because you realize that behavior is complicated. It's easy to call people bad. It's harder to ask why. And so, yeah, so my new book sort of looks at behavior and past childhood trauma through that lens.
Maybe we should define terms a little bit here because it's an extraordinarily complicated situation. There's a lot of ideas out there about what brain health is, what mental health is. Can you address some of the common misconceptions you've come across and what the truth is?
Yes. So I'm a neurosurgical ICU nurse. So for me, it was science. It was like, I didn't want to deal with walkie-talkies, people who talked. I didn't want to deal with any sort of mental health issues. Before I met my husband, I was like, I wanted him sedated and intubated. That was just easier for me. I didn't realize how much that was really a testament to me sort of burying my own past. It's just like, I really didn't want to dig into some of that stuff. I never also realized that like when my husband talks about brain injuries at Amon Clinics, we actually have done so many studies that show that even minor brain injuries affect behavior. They affect the decisions you make. They affect the outcomes in your life. But when, as a neurosurgical ICU nurse, I thought brain injury meant you cracked your skull open, right? Not true. Even minor injuries affect a lot of things in your life. So when you begin to see mental health through the lens of brain health, it changes everything.
That's interesting. So how does having more empathy change that conversation around mental and emotional health?
Past childhood trauma is a big part of why we end up being so judgmental. I know for me, it's like the reason I just could not deal for the longest time with working with addicts, people with addiction. So because I would label them as addicts, as opposed to seeing them as people with addiction. And so, but that's because there was so much pain in my childhood, so much pain in my family. When you begin to see it through the lens of brain health, when you begin to develop empathy, for me at first, I was like, wait, do I really want to do that? Because now I have to change how I feel about these people, right? I have to change how I feel about this entire group of people, how I've been thinking about things my whole life. But what I came to understand is this. Just because you have empathy, it doesn't mean that there aren't consequences. It doesn't mean that, you know, people who do something that hurt other people, that doesn't mean they're going home today if they're in jail, right? It just means that it begins to destigmatize it so we're able to have conversations. So we can begin to build bridges, not walls, so we can get proper treatment for people. But if we don't understand it, we're not going to do that. We're just going to say, their problem, not mine. But it's not. It's all of our problem.
Something that comes up a lot when we at Relevant have this conversation is we hear from people who really lean into spirituality over science and even sometimes ignoring science. What would you say to someone who says, well, I've got my Bible and I've got my pastor, I'm good?
At Amon Clinics, we treat people through four lenses. Biological, what's going on with your body? Did you have a head injury? Do you have a thyroid imbalance? Did you have Lyme disease? Do you have some other infection that's affecting your mental health? Psychology, what is your thinking like? Are you controlling and managing your mind? Which is, that is where prayer and the Bible are so wonderful and your community is so wonderful. Because that's really, I mean, the Bible talks constantly about managing your mind, right? About prayer. So that's really important. Then there's the social circle. Who you hang out with matters. Not going to church has been really hard for a lot of people. It's been hard for me because who you hang out with matters. If you're listening to the news all day and that's who you're hanging out with all day, it's going to be very different than if you're hanging out with people on Zoom praying, right? The outcome is going to be very different. People are contagious. And then there is the spiritual circle. Now at Amon Clinics, we treat people according to all of those. And we understand not everybody has our Christian belief system, but it's still important to understand what gives your life meaning and purpose. It's really critical because purposeful people live longer. They do better. They get well faster. It's really critical. So at our clinics, we believe that you have to treat people with mental health issues through all of those circles. We don't think they should be separated, if that makes sense. But if you had a heart condition, would you say, oh, I'm going to ignore it. I'm just going to pray. We would still want you to pray and we would want you to go get your heart treated.
Is Tana Amon. For more content like this, make sure to check out our wellness series every Tuesday and Thursday at relevantmagazine.com. Thanks, UHSM. Also, thank you to Ron Howard for joining us today. Make sure to check out his new movie, Hillbilly Elegy. It is out now. And while you're checking things out, check out the new issue of Relevant. It's available for free, thanks to UHSM, at relevantmagazine.com. Features Matthew McConaughey on the cover. Letitia Wright is in it. Features with Jen Hatmaker, Lisa Turkers, Social Club Misfits, Brooke Ligertwood, and a lot more. There's also an awesome gift guide for your Christmas gift buying. We break down some of our favorite finds from across the internet. Go check it out. It's available now at relevantmagazine.com. On that note, we'll wrap it up. I'm Cameron Strang.
I'm Jesse Carey.
I'm Jamie Ivey.
And I'm Derek Miner.
Have a great Black Friday weekend, everyone. Don't spend too much.
Thanks for listening to the Relevant Podcast. Check out our features, interviews, and news updates every day at relevantmagazine.com. And make sure to follow Relevant on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for the latest. For more great podcasts, browse the shows on the Relevant Podcast Network, which you can find at our site. And while you're there, don't miss the all-new era of Relevant Magazine. A new issue releases every other month at relevantmagazine.com.
But Hillary's emails from this private server?
Relevant Podcast Network.